Thank you. Good evening. It being Thanksgiving Eve, I want to thank you all for choosing and electing to spend your evening with each other and myself this evening. I also want to thank Dora, who took the time to staple all these sheets for us today, which must have been time-consuming and paper-cutting, so I appreciate that. It's also Rosh Chodesh, a time of renewal, so I'm happy to start a new series, see you all here. And I want to begin. Anyone ever heard of Intelligence Squared? Good. I'll make it up. In the UK, a few years ago, they started these publicly broadcasted debates called Intelligence Squared debates. They would take politicians, public intellectuals, celebrities, and they would put them on the stage, have a moderator, and have them debate a motion. And then at the end, they would see who won by taking a poll of the audience. However, we all know that nobody goes into a debate as a blank slate. Nobody goes in just happy to be swayed. You've got an opinion. They had a debate on whether Zionism is racism. Do you think anybody went in? I don't know. I'll see what they got to say. Maybe a couple people. So the way that they judge who won the debate is actually quite smart. They take a poll when people come in, and then they take a poll at the end, and then you can see how many people have been swayed, and then you can judge the results based on the sway rather than the popular vote. The popular vote not being that popular, I've noticed, across the world. So I'm going to take a straw poll at the beginning. How many people think dignity is important? Maybe I should have started the other way. How many people think dignity is unimportant? All right. Well, we'll base the success of this year then to see how many of you sway to think it's unimportant. That's not going to be my argument, in which case it will be a terrible year if you come out having mood. So we'll see. Now, it so happens that human dignity being a value, being important, is one of the areas of most overlapping consensus in the West today. You can go to almost, and not just the West, almost any culture will say that human dignity is central, vital, and important to everything else. But it is astonishingly recent. If you spoke to somebody 200 years ago, let me know because you've got access to a time machine, but if you do speak to somebody from 200 years ago, the idea that dignity is somehow inherent in every one of us would have been a completely foreign concept, even if you were speaking to people who spoke English. Dignity 200 years ago was actually a signal of inequality. People had dignity who were dignitaries. It was a signal of elite superiority. That's what dignity meant, people who were superior. But in the last 100 years or so, it has shifted its meaning, and it has come to mean something fundamental about who we are as human beings. And in fact, it was first canonized as a moral right or a moral term in 1948 in the United Nations, and it's hard to escape the reality that in some sense it was a reaction to what took place in the 40s. Seeing how low human beings had gone, and they weren't barbarians in culture. These were cultured people who celebrated Bach and Mendelssohn, not Moses, but his grandson Felix. They were people who considered themselves scientists and philosophers and yet brutalized their own population. And in reaction to that, this idea that human dignity shall not be infringed erupted. Top of page 2, we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, UDHR, for those who can make acronyms. And this is how it begins. This is the preamble. Recognition, you're going to have to turn in after the first page, sorry. Recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace. Meaning, if you value freedom, or if you value justice, or if you value peace, by definition, you have to value dignity. Because without human dignity, nothing else can flourish, nothing else can thrive. That's a view taken in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, and that's the preamble. And Article 1, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and in rights. That was reaffirmed in 1966 when they had the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. He also had one on economic and social rights, starting with the same preamble that recognition of dignity is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace. Now, how many times does the word dignity appear in the Declaration of Independence of the United States? It's Thanksgiving. I'm a citizen, I had to study for this test. I don't know how many of you did. How many times did it come up, Declaration of Independence? Never. Okay, how many times does it come up in the Constitution? Guess? Guess? No, was that your guess or you knew? It was a good one. Yes. For those who were paying attention, 200 years ago, it wouldn't have meant what it means today. And when was the Declaration and the Constitution written? More than that, right? More than 200 years ago. Dignity does not appear in the Constitution. Yet, in 2015, 4 years ago, one of the most far-reaching Supreme Court decisions in modern times, and by far-reaching, not necessarily legally, but culturally, was what we could call a Rubicon, which is a term for a threshold. Dignity was foundational to approving and legalizing same-sex marriage in the United States. Because nowhere in the Constitution does it say that same-sex marriage should be legal. It wasn't something that had been overlooked for 200 years. And the author of that decision, anyone know who authored that decision? It's in the source on number three. Justice Kennedy. And who actually just retired from the bench about 3 years ago. I think Justice Kavanaugh took his place on the bench. Is that people were just shaking in despair or disagreeing?
Despair.
Oh, despair. All right. I can take despair. Disagreement, I'm less good. So I say? It was about a year ago? All right. Time flies when you're getting berated with the news.
Despair.
Yeah, when you're in despair. And this was his opinion. From the beginning of their most recent page, the annals of human history reveal the transcendent importance of marriage. The lifelong union of a man and a woman always has promised nobility and dignity to all persons. You could argue with that. You could say that marriage 2,000 years ago didn't give that much dignity to women. It involved more than one wife, and basically you were treated as chattel, it's possible. But this is his view, that marriage, at least in its most idealist construction, was about giving dignity to people to choose who to spend their life with. And then he has, no union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than they once were, etc., etc. Underlined piece right at the end. They ask same-sex couples for equal dignity in the eyes of the law, and the Constitution grants them that right. The judgment of the Court of Appeals of the Sixth Circuit is reversed. It is so ordered. That was the end of that. People ask for dignity. The Constitution guarantees them dignity. Full stop. The people who objected to this ruling said the Constitution doesn't guarantee anybody dignity. The word dignity doesn't appear in the Constitution. This is what they call judicial activism. He is interpreting what they might have meant according to today's values. And I'm not here to object or endorse one view or another, but merely see that dignity in the last 100 years has come to be a monopoly on our cultural imagination. In fact, there was a law passed in Israel, Chok Yesod, foundational law, Kvod HaAdam VeCheruto, the dignity of man or human beings and their freedom. And it lists, number one, Zichuyot HaYesod Shel Adam BeYisrael, the rights, foundational rights of people in Israel, Meshutatot Al HaKara BeErech HaAdam, are based, founded on recognizing the value of the human person, b'kedushat chayav, in the sanctity of their life, of yoto ben charin, in that they are free, v'hen yachobdu baruach ha'ikronot ba'azkaral kama miden Yisrael, and this respects the spirit of the founding of Israel. 1 Aleph, chok yesod zeh matarato, what is the purpose of this law? L'hagen al kvod ha'adam, to defend the dignity, kvod ha'adam, the dignity of people. Dignity is centrally important. Having said that, I'll now ask for a raise of hands again. Who wants to define dignity for me? Who wants to define that term in less than two sentences? Okay, so 100% of us thought it was important. 0% of us want, I'm not saying you can't, but none of you want to define it. Anyone want to take a guess? I'm not saying there's a right answer. Honor.
Respect.
Respect. Respect. Yeah, I wouldn't claim for a moment that nobody thought that human honor or respect was important for 2,000 years, but the word dignity did not have that meaning. Okay, respect, honor.
Value of the individual.
Individual value, which is interesting because it was precisely around the time of the Enlightenment when individual people started to attain value that figures like Kant and Rousseau started speaking of, the individual value. They didn't use the term dignity, although translators of the German from Kant did use the word dignity when translating it, but that was later. Individual value, okay. In 2008, oh, this is a question, a trivia question. Anybody know what the front page story of the New York Times was on September 11th, 2001? Probably you know what it's not. Because the tragedy happened that day, the papers had gone to print. It was about stem cell research, which was a major issue at the time, an ethical challenge, and it came off the papers for obvious reasons and didn't get picked up again for a while. The country was going through a lot of turmoil. But that was the front page news at the time. And George W. Bush, had appointed an ethics panel to determine this issue, how to navigate this. In fact, the figure I mentioned, Leon Kass, a couple of weeks ago on Shabbos, he was head of that panel, selected by George Bush. And they have an ethics panel since to try and deal with these issues. They get professors, intellectuals to kind of sort out the legal issues. And in 2008, the President's Council on Bioethics, this is source 4, sent a letter of transmittal to the President. Who was President at the time, 2008? George Bush. Right? The election of President Obama was the end of 2008. I was not yet in America, so if they would ask me, I may have had a different answer. But I came in August of 2008, right before the crash, so sorry about that.
Your fault?
Yeah, it was my fault. The pound was pretty good back then. I could get a good deal. Now I get a good deal the other way. But this is what the president of the Council on Bioethics sent in their final conclusion, which had pages and pages of papers written by numerous people. This was the front level. Dear Mr. President, there is no universal agreement on the meaning of the term human dignity. Sincerely, Edmund Pellegrino, excellent use of taxpayer dollars. Right? They had a council on bioethics to come around the idea. What does dignity mean? How do I assure it? How do I legally employ this term? And they came and they said, much like everyone in this room, we don't really have consensus on how to term this, but we know it when we see it. We know it when we feel it. We know what dignity is. I'm not really sure how to debate it. So clearly it's a value. We're not entirely sure how to term it, but we're left with two questions to investigate because we're not American constitutionalists and we're not Israeli Knesset constitutionalists. We are halachic Jews sitting here with a question, and we're going to have two. Number one, is dignity a halachic value? Is this a Jewish value? We all seem to value it. Is that because we have been influenced? I wouldn't say infected, but we have been influenced by our culture. Or is this a halachic value? You've got an answer. You could save us a lot of time.
Kavod habrios.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're done. Let's go home. Kavod habrios. Okay, that is a halachic term, which we'll come to over page. We'll come to. But that's question one. Is dignity a Jewish value, a halachic value? Number two is, okay, values are great in a vacuum, but values very rarely exist in a vacuum. What happens when it comes into conflict with other values? Dignity is great. What if it conflicts with another value? And I'll give you a clue, or I'll give you an example. Anyone heard of dignitas? Anyone heard of the word dignitas? It's Latin, but it is actually the Latin where dignity comes from. But it's actually an organization in Switzerland, which has been taking patients for the last 15 years, where it is legal to... they basically do assisted suicides, where it is legal to take your own life. But you can't just turn up for the day and give them some money and they give you a room. There are all sorts of legal barriers against how this is used. And it is specifically for terminally ill patients who are afflicted by conditions that are harrowing to observe and harrowing to experience. And they have to get approval from doctors, it has to be double signed, they have to have their own wits about them, they have to perform it themselves. Nobody can do this to anybody else. They have all sorts of ethical guards in place so that nobody could say, you know what, I'm really exhausted looking after this person, I'm going to take him and I'm just going to get this done with and it'll be fine. That is not approved by the Supreme Court of Switzerland. So they've got all sorts of barriers in place. But dignitas, and there were issues in London because people, it's illegal in the United Kingdom, assisted suicide, but people would fly their family members to Switzerland to do it and come back one less passenger. And the question would be,
do you arrest them?
Do you arrest them? Was that a crime? It's legal where they were. It's illegal here. We know what you did. How do we deal with this issue? And that's when dignity comes up against another value. What value is dignity coming up against?
Life.
Human life. Human life. And I think any of us who know people who have gone through aging, who have had debilitating or harrowing conditions, understand. And even without those debilitating conditions, just aging itself can lead to a level of indignity that makes it hard. I remember when my grandfather, who was had total control over his mental faculties. But as he got older, he was an active man. He was involved with leading communal organizations. He was a businessman, built it up from nothing. And as he got older and older and older, and I'd spend time with him, I remember there were times where he would say, I can't even take a shower by myself, and I've just got no dignity left. He would say that a lot. I've got no dignity. And it's difficult to hear. And dignity, he never for one moment suggested that he would have wanted to do anything like dignitas, but that's when dignity comes up against the value of life. And I remember at the time the head rabbinic figure of reform in the United Kingdom wrote a column about his wife who had a horrific condition and ended up wanting to take her own life, and it was illegal, but he wrote in the paper, if it were legal, I would have done it, and I would have been comfortable with it, and I would have been happy with it, and I would have given her that final dignity. So dignity in a vacuum is great. Is it good to look good? Is it good to have a sense of self-respect and a sense of honor? I think 100% of us agreed with that. The question then becomes, what happens when that comes in conflict with other values? Which values give way to it? Which values don't? So we're going to turn the page to page 3 to start with question 1. And I'll give you a little teaser. Question 1 again is dignity a Jewish value? Question 2 is, what happens when that value comes into conflict with something else? Taking for granted, as Saul did, that dignity is a Jewish value, and we still don't really know how to define dignity, but we would know indignity when we see it. Let's say you're in Seasons. Who here shops at Seasons? All right, Aaron's?
Yeah.
All right, we're setting off a civil war. Okay. Who here just presses a button on the internet and somebody brings it to the door? All right. Just me then. You're in the middle of Seasons, Aaron's, other shops are available. And you're walking along and suddenly you realize, oh, I put on the wrong jacket. And I remember this jacket has shatness in it. This jacket is kilayim. And I needed to get it changed and removed. I'm wearing it in the middle of the store. Do you have to take it off? What's your guess? Yes or no? Yes. Okay, that's your jacket. Your shirt. Your socks. I don't want to get too graphic. You know where I'm going next. What do? You're standing in the store. You're wearing shatness. That's where you have a value and dignity come into conflict. My human dignity would be compromised if I was shamed or humiliated or bare in the middle of Seasons. They might give me a good deal to get me out quick. But it's not what I would call dignity. But at the same time, I'm in violation of a biblical prohibition. So that's where the question becomes complicated, and we're going to address that. But first, we're going to address, is dignity a Jewish value? And I want to just go through a litany of sources that is going to give you zero question in your mind to ever hesitate about lifting your hand, which none of you did. But that should not be a question. And the good way to think about this, imagine you're at the bus stop. Anyone here ever take the bus? Excellent. If you're not on a bus stop, you're at a train station, you're on a plane, and someone looks at you and says, you look like you're an observant Jew. And you say, you're just looking at my nose. I'm not wearing kippah. Why are you so rude? You look like an observant Jew. And I've got a question for you. Does Judaism value dignity? Because it was only in 1948 that it was enshrined in moral terminology. Israel only passed a law in 1992. Is this a Jewish value? So what I want to do is just go through a list of sources very quickly, which will be possibly not quick, to show that you wouldn't have to hum and haw and say, yeah, I'm pretty sure, I'm confident, I feel that it is, but yes it is, and I'll give you 15 sources, and then they won't talk to you for the rest of the flight. Win-win. Top of the page, Rabbi Soloveitchik, to be be human means to live with dignity. Okay, that seems pretty straightforward. He's defining what it means to be human as to live with dignity. Again, we haven't defined that term, but that seems straightforward. Rabbi Lichtenstein, his son-in-law and student. The maximal, and you'll get a sense of their different styles of writing in this sentence. The maximal realization of the dignity and sanctity potentially inherent in the human personality is itself an ethical imperative of the highest order. Yeah. Okay, let's put that simply. To be human means to live with dignity. Right. So, essentially, it's a little different, because Rabbi Soloveitchik just defined what it means to be human as to have dignity. Rav Lichtenstein is saying there are times when we are undignified. There are times when dignity is lost, and we have an imperative to maximize that. So that's even stronger. And then Rabbi Sacks, who's writing again, you'll get a sense for here, takes an even more strident view. The ultimate value that we should be concerned to maximize is human dignity. The ultimate value. Now, something that Rabbi Sacks has as a practice, rhetorically incredibly powerful, is to make sweeping universal statements all the time. And if you're ever in a debate, it's a great way to sway an audience. You just say, the most important thing in the history of humankind, and people start listening because they think this is the most important thing in the history of humankind. I should tune in. So we can't necessarily hold him to a formulation here, but it's pretty stark. The ultimate value we should be concerned to maximize is human dignity. Now, those three figures all lived in which century? The 20th century. Rabbi Sacks is still living, but he did also live in the 20th century. So they're all 20th century figures. So you could reasonably say, okay, those are three modern Orthodox rabbis who were influenced by their culture to express and endorse dignity. And they were in the wake of the Shoah as well. And they're part of this reaction. So let's go to the 13th century figure, the Beit HaBechira, also known as the Meiri, who said as follows, Kavod HaBriot, Chaviv Ad Ma'ot. Kavod HaBriot, how would you literally translate that for me? Kavod, honor of Briot. What is a Bria? Bria just means a creature, which we'll come back to in part two of this series, but because it doesn't apply to animals, it just applies to human beings. Maybe we'll talk about it today, who knows? Maybe I'll talk about it now. Kavod HaBriot means, for our intents and purposes, it's going to mean human dignity. Chaviv Ad Ma'od is deeply beloved. Ein lecha mida chaviva mimena. There is no trait more beloved than this. So Rabbi Sacks obviously was channeling the Meiri. This is the most important thing. Now how do we know? Give me some sources. Where is there a pasuk in the Torah that says Kavod HaBriot is important? What's the biblical source for human dignity? I'm asking. What's the biblical source for human dignity? Okay, we're looking ahead. There you go. Excellent. But if you look before it says Bamidbar, what's the word? Rashi, thank you. So what is the biblical source for human dignity?
Tzelem Elokim.
Okay, so we could say that we're made with Tzelem Elokim in the image of God, but that doesn't, again, that doesn't really define our term dignity. I'm in the image of God, but who says I should be trying to be dignified? In fact, there are sects of faiths all over the world that believe that because they're in the image of God, they have to afflict their bodies to try and get the soul, the image out of them. So that's not necessarily evidence that we should be treating ourselves with respect, that we should be dressed. I mean, I'll give you a clue. What's the biblical source for human dignity? There isn't one. There does not seem to be a verse anywhere that endorses this. Human beings are central. It's hard to think about the biblical text without thinking about the centrality of human beings. That's what drives the narrative. God reached out to the heavens and gave us the Torah. He forged humankind with his own hands, with his own breath. It's obviously important, but there is no sentence anywhere that says, in a legal context, human dignity needs to be preserved. That's a very interesting point. Adam and Eve get clothed by God as they leave Eden, which is problematic for a couple of reasons. Number one, 5 minutes earlier, they clothed themselves. They made fig leaves for themselves. God said, okay, you didn't do a very good job. I'll give you some leather. But also, we'll talk about this around Bereshit, but what did he clothe them in? Anybody know? What does it say in the Pasuk? Anyone lame Bereshit? Caught not? Or? What does that mean? Garments of
skin,
leather, Reb Meir had it as homiletically with an aleph to say garments of light, which awakens the mystics in our tradition. But what leather? What skin? This is going to spoil the drasha that I plan to give next, Parshas Bereishis. So there is a midrash that actually it was snake skin. And that he was clothing them in a reminder of their error. And it wasn't to provide them with dignity, but to provide them with a sense of eternal shame. Which is a very stark way of reading it. And I'm going to give you the other options. I would, but I'm going to save them for next Bereishis. Because I nearly gave that this year, and I said, oh, I'll save that for next year. So I'm not going to out myself now. So that's that. But that's a good point. But biblically speaking, there is no pasuk anywhere. The Ten Commandments never says anything. It says a lot about God, a lot about other people, very little about ourselves, very little about dignity. But the sages seem to feel this is pretty important. The Meiri felt this is important, but the Meiri's in the 13th century. Is there nothing before that? Let's have a look at Rashi, who was marginally before that. What happened to the donkey that Bilam was riding? Anybody know? Let's put it this way. After the event with Bilam...
Didn't he get killed when the mountains hit Bilam and he was flying on the donkey or something like that?
So that's an interesting midrash. But in the biblical text, we don't really get a sense of what happens to him. He just disappears. And I say him because it was male and, I don't know, he was speaking, so we'll give him a gender. When was this donkey made, according to tradition? The first 6 days of creation. This was a pretty significant animal. And Rashi, picking up on Midrashic tradition, says this donkey was killed instantly after the episode with Bilam. Why? This is source 9. Because it spoke and it rebuked you. And it said, there's an angel here, man. You're meant to be a prophet. Give me a break. And you, prophet of God, Bilam, were basically embarrassed by this donkey. It showed you up. There's a donkey seeing an angel and you're standing there meant to be a prophet. That's why it was killed. Shelo yomru, so that nobody should ever say, Zuhi shesalkat Bilam betochachta v'lo yuchal lashiv. This is the donkey that showed up Bilam. I heard a colleague of mine say, can you imagine every yeshiva dinner for the next year, their guest of honor would be this donkey. Stand up, tell us your story. This is the donkey that embarrassed Bilam, that gave him shame, that showed him not to be a prophet of God. And it would be shameful. Shechas hamakom al kavod habriot. And God has mercy, compassion on human dignity. This is not a saint. This is Bilam, who tried to curse us from multiple angles on multiple occasions. And yet, his shame was intolerable, is intolerable to God, because human beings deserve dignity, shouldn't be shamed and embarrassed. In the next source 10, I just have this for a little bit of fun. You ever wondered why animals don't speak? No, I don't wonder so much. But it's a reasonable question. Why are we the only ones in possession of language? Scientifically, we are more intelligent. We have more neurons firing. I went to the museum, what is it? The Museum of Science, the New York Science Hall. There you go, I got all the words, just the wrong order. We went there on Sunday and they had a nice little display of different sized brains that traumatized my children. Yeah, that was lovely. Daddy, what's that? Cake! Let's move on. So yes, there's a scientific reason that we are in possession of language, but why did God craft the universe that way? Snakes used to speak, apparently. So what do we do? Ba'ur A, the Midrash says, these are the sages, and this is a late Midrash, medieval. Come and see how God cares about human dignity, how much He goes to preserve human dignity. V'yadat sarachan, and knows their needs, human beings, v'satam piot habeimot, and keeps the animals shtum. Animals can't speak in the eyes of this sage, of this Midrash, because they would shame us all. They don't have impulse. They don't have instinct. They don't fail. They're not unethical. They just do what they're programmed to do. And they would look at us as corrupt, tainted, base beings driven by passion and self-interest. And they would look like the donkey at Bilam and say, what are you doing? There's angels here. And we would be shamed. And that's why the whole universe is mute apart from us. And we see it as a sign of superiority. We've got bigger brains than them. And the Midrash here inverts that to suggest actually we may have bigger brains, but we are more morally bankrupt. And that's why the universe echoes in silence, to spare us shame. Which is a pretty pessimistic view of the cosmos. But I thought I would share that with you, because again, it's trying to ratchet up how much God cares about human dignity, despite the fact there's no biblical text. In the next source, source 11, Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and this is on the theme of preserving dignity of even those who are criminal, those who are villainous. Source 11, Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Barei kama gadol kavod habriyot, come and see how great human dignity is. And by the way, why do these sages keep having to ask, come and see how great it is? Because it's not in the biblical text. They keep having to drill in. It's so important. It really is. I'm telling you, it's really important. Much like Olam Haba. Is the world to come in the biblical text?
No,
but it occupies quite a lot of our discourse. Because it's not in the biblical text. Shosha halach baraglav chamisha. Somebody steals an ox. Anyone here ever stolen an ox? Okay, good. Anyone here ever seen an ox?
The zoo.
The zoo? Okay, I'm sure you've seen documentaries on television as well. We all know what oxes are. Anyone been to Wall Street? They got a big ox there, right? Oh, that's a bull. Is there a difference? All right, so that's how much I've seen an ox. A bull, there's not really a difference, right? They're the same animal.
No.
Bison, that's different. All right, I had a bison burger in Denver once. Tastes like meat. I'll Google it. We're going to find out if ox...
No Wi-Fi.
There's Wi-Fi.
There is Wi-Fi.
Without, no need for a password. I shouldn't have told you. You're going to be in Netflix in 3 seconds.
No.
So, stealing an ox, for those of you I'll describe who have not seen it, it is not something you would put on your shoulder. Unless it was a baby ox. Which is probably called a bull. Sorry? All right. So, oxes are heavy. The way you steal them is, you grab onto their, it's not called a muzzle, that's what dogs have. What's it called?
Yoke.
Yoke?
Leash.
Well, if it's in the middle of plowing, you would grab its yoke. A leash is probably more for dogs than oxen. You grab onto its neck, on the collar. Thank you. Collar, and you pull it out. How do you steal a sheep? Oh, I see, we're more familiar with sheep stealing. Okay, good. You pick a sheep up and you put it on your shoulder. So if you thieve sheep or oxen, you have to pay back 4 or 5, depending on the animal. What is the rationale? So arbitrary, so random. And the sage of this midrash says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, see how much God cares about human dignity. Someone who steals an ox, which involves dragging it out, not that undignified, has to pay back 5. Sesher kivok tefav arba'a. But a thief who steals a sheep puts it on their shoulder. It's not going to. You're not going to pull it out. You put it on your shoulder, which is undignified. To have an animal on you, it's probably nervous. It's being stolen. It's going to relieve itself on you. This is not a pleasant experience. And you underwent some form of self-degradation. You went under some humiliation. And God says, okay, the punishment will be less. So even when treating the criminal, maybe criminally insane to steal a sheep like that, is given less punishment. Not no punishment, but less punishment because they underwent indignity while taking it out.
Turns out the ox underwent bigger indignity than them.
Say that again.
An ox is a castrated bull.
Oh, I knew it. They are the same. Really?
You wouldn't say that.
Yeah, if I was an ox, I wouldn't say they're the same. That's true. All right, good to know. We give them a new name just because of that? Okay. All right, got to give them something. Okay, good to know. Thank you. I will use that in trivia. Shabbos table conversation. Or not. Source 13, we have something that is familiar probably to many of us, cast in a new light. Who doesn't have to go to war? Who's exempt from war in Jewish law?
First
year of marriage. Why are you don't have to fight for the first year of marriage?
Wife won't let it.
Say again?
The wife won't let it.
The wife won't let it? Okay, that's one option. I'll only say, because we're being recorded, this is not in my name. When I asked this question in Chicago, somebody said, because you can't fight on two fronts. Yeah, I do not endorse that position. But US, first year of marriage, you're exempt from war. Who else doesn't have to go to war?
New house.
New house.
New vineyard.
New vineyard. Who else?
Afraid.
We come last. The one who is afraid. And it seems like these are all distinct reasons. You just got married, you'd have a year at home. You're scared, you're not going to be that helpful on the battlefield. You just got a new vineyard, you should get to enjoy it. But the Midrash here in the Sifrei is an old Midrash, an ancient Midrash. Ba'urei kamachasa makam kavod ha'briyas. Who among that group is going to be embarrassed to go home? Who among that group that we've just said is exempt is going to feel shame at walk turning around and saying,
the one who's
scared, the one who's going home to his wife, I've just got married, the one who's built a new house. People say, I understand, you want to enjoy that. You're scared? You don't think we're all scared? You're a coward. There's shame. And here, the Midrash says, see how much God cares about human dignity. Mipnei ha-yarei v'harach levav. The people who are scared and terrified, who should only be the ones who are exempt. Those are really the only ones who should be exempt from war. This is war. This is a communal effort. I understand you just got married. I understand you just built a house. We're all fighting to defend our wives and our homes and our families. You need to be here too. The American Armed Forces doesn't let you off if you got married. You can go home to get married and then you go back to war. The only people who should not be at war are the people who are scared. They're going to be ineffective. It's going to lower morale. And strategically, it's a bad move. But God cares so much about dignity. He comes up with categories of exemptions so that when everybody goes home, nobody knows who's scared. Nobody knows who got married. Nobody knows got a new home. Nobody knows got a new vineyard. Everybody's going home and they've got different reasons. Maybe there are some scared, but nobody has to hang their head in shame when going home. We're willing to compromise militarily, martially, strategically, in order to save the dignity of those who are scared. That's that Midrash. And the Rambam Maimonides I have at the end here, who's obviously a little later than these Midrashim, who suggest in the legal context, in the judicial context, that judges, as we're learning through the news every day, have immense power. And they have more power in the halakhic context than they do here. As he's about to say, if somebody is misbehaving, lash them. You're the judge. See, do what you see is fit. Yesh lebet din, source 14, the court can, the halkot misha in muchiyav malkut, someone who is not obligated to get lashes, ulaharog misha in muchiyav mita, and kill people who do not deserve the death penalty from a legal perspective. They have that power, the Rambam says. V'chein yesh lebet din b'kol makom v'kol zman l'halkot adam sheshmua Torah. And the bet din in any place at any time has the right to lash someone. There's got to be a better term than lash. Sheshmua Torah, who has bad rumors about them. The bet din can whip somebody who is victim of rumors. And people talk about him being loose and depraved. They can get lashes, either to make a public point about it, or because you trust the fact that people are talking about it, that something is going on. Skip down to Tet. This is, I don't know what line, line 7 in the middle, Tet. And they can tie up their hands and legs, put them in jail, and push them down into the ground. These are the kind of things that if and when Western armed forces have done, they've been accused of war crimes. In fact, that's just in the news as well this week. But this has come up repeatedly over time. And it's very difficult when you're a soldier and you're trained to kill. And you're under immense stress and your friends are dying and you're thinking of your family and you're away from home to maintain a level of dignity on the battlefield. And in the West, and in Israel, of course, they uphold these laws. And here the Rambam is saying that you can perform as a bet din, you have the right to give people undignified treatment. However, yud. Kol elu ha-dvarim lefima sheyira ha-dayan. All these things have to be as the judge sees fit. Shezer ra'ui lekach v'hashad sricha. And that it is necessary and appropriate. V'chol shiu ma'asav l'shem shamayim. And it has to be for the sake of heaven. You can't push this person on the ground. You can't lock him up because it makes you feel good. Anyone seen Shawshank Redemption? So, I can't remember what he's called. Not the governor, but the guy who supervises the jail.
The warden.
The warden. Thank you. That's what we're talking about. That he locks up the guy in solitary confinement for a month because it makes him feel better. The guards just routinely beat and hit people because it makes them feel better. They nearly throw them off the roof at one point. And I'm saying Shawshank Redemption, which of course is a work of fiction, but this happens in real life too. And he's saying, no, that is not endorsed in the Jewish judicial system. You are allowed to give harsh punishment, but it has to be for the sake of heaven. Va'al yiyeh kavod habriyot kal be'enav, and never ever should human dignity be low in your eyes. Yossi Klein Halevi, anyone know that name? He's an interesting public intellectual. He wrote a book last year called Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor. In the introduction, which is essentially a book which was published for free online in Arabic, because he really did want his Palestinian neighbors to read it, but he wrote it in English for an American audience as well. And he speaks about his experience in the army when he had a sense that he was treating the enemy and hostiles with indignity, and he was kind of pushed into a scenario where the peer pressure made it inescapable to do that. And when his son went to the army, he told him, you're going to fight, you may even have to kill, but never, ever treat somebody without dignity. And he speaks about it in the beginning of the book. He says, we have to take life sometimes. We have to defend ourselves, but we never, ever take another person's dignity. And the Rambam is essentially saying that in a separate context. That even when we have to inflict punishment, and almost all the examples we have here, Bilam, a thief, people being tied up in court, these are villains, these are criminals. That's where human dignity is tested. Not do we think you should have an unstained suit. Not should you wear a nice tie. We're not talking about that kind of dignity as our prototypical examples, but where it's really tested. Where you might have an instinct to say, throw it out the window. I'm not going to get down the political rabbit hole. But it is precisely when our values are tested that they most matter. It's easy to uphold law and dignity when it's not being tested. And the idea that our enemies don't value dignity, so why should we, is not a compelling argument. Because that's why we're fighting them. This isn't just a war of survival, us versus them. It's a clash of civilizations. We're fighting to defend dignity and justice and freedom and peace and respect and honor. Not just my own heartbeat. So why should we compromise on what we're fighting to defend? And the Rambam essentially says that's a Jewish value. Now, so if you're on that plane or that bus stop or that train station, you now have a definitive answer, which I'm sure you already all did. Yes, human dignity is a Jewish value. Kavod habriyot. We, even for Bilam, even for a thief, we consider... And by the way, how many people saw that thief carrying a sheep on his shoulders running out of the farm? Presumably.
Nobody.
Presumably nobody. It's the middle of the night. They don't have CCTV. They don't have... what is it called? Detectors, light detectors. Nobody saw this guy. And the Torah to me says nobody saw this guy. But he lost dignity in his own eyes. I don't know why he didn't feel undignified stealing, but he lost dignity carrying it. And maybe if we're generous, we can think this isn't just a heist from German jeweled castles, but this is somebody who is on the verge of starvation, on the brink of failing their own family, and they need to get food. And to do that, they have to put a sheep on their shoulder. Can you imagine? We're not just thinking about a guy, you know, with a black and white striped shirt with a little bandana on. We're talking about somebody who's stealing to survive. And they go through the indignity of having to carry an animal on their back with its wool and its dirt just to feed its family. And obviously you get punished for stealing. You can't have anarchy. But we have compassion when people undergo indignity. Okay, so let's turn the page. We have a few minutes remaining and only two pages. We're going to have to figure out how to balance the time here. And by we, I of course mean me. Page 4. What happens when that value of dignity conflicts with halakha? Now, I assume in the most concrete situation that we mentioned in the context of dignitas, somebody feels they're losing dignity and want to take their own life. What do you think the Jewish view, the halakhic view is on that? For or against? I'll then ask you what you're for and against, because that was not clear in the question. But we had against. Meaning, Jewish law would not permit you to take your own life or somebody else's life to give them dignity. There's an that is correct. There is an interesting question about whether you are permitted to pray for somebody's demise. whether you are permitted and say, look, they're not in a state that they feel healthy, they're not in a state that anyone feels that they have dignity, and they tell me every day they can't take it anymore. Am I allowed to pray? Do I have to pray for Refuah Shleima? Should I pray for Refuah Shleima? Should I pray that they should go painlessly? That is a question. We're not going to answer that now. But that is addressed.
There is a Gemara where one of the rabbis was praying for somebody to die.
I'm not sure which Gemara you're referring to, but there is one where that happens, and that was not out of compassion, but because he didn't like him.
No, it was one. There was a handful of
where. Okay, you'll share that with me. Yeah.
But don't pray for his death.
Yeah. Don't have me in mind as you're looking at it. But there are Gemaras all over the place where rabbis look at somebody with a bit of a wink and then they fall into a pile of dust. Also, halakhically not recommended. Or empowered to modern day rabbis. I've tried. If you see me on the bimah going like that, I'm not just tired. Doesn't work. So, you're in the middle of seasons, errands. You suddenly discover, oh my gosh, I'm wearing shatnez underwear. This is going to be awkward. What do I do? Top of page 4, Gemara in Brachot. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav has some very, very disappointing news for almost all of us, I would imagine. Hamotzi kalaim bevigdo. You find, I'd advise you not looking for kalaim while you're wearing the clothes. But if you find kilayim in your clothes, poshtan afilu bashuk, you have to take them off even in the middle of the marketplace. Seems straightforward. Not to do, but that seems straightforward. My Tama, what's the reason? How can you say that, the Gemara says? Answer, a verse for Mishle. So we have a biblical verse, but as a source not for dignity, but for dignity's lack of worth. Ein chachma ve'ein tfuna ve'ein etza l'neged Hashem. There is no wisdom, there is no understanding, there is no counsel against God. Meaning, if God gives you a prohibition, if God gives you an instruction, don't come at me with svaras about dignity. God said you can't wear shatnez. You're in the market. I'm sorry. Tell everybody to turn around, but you're taking it off. Kol makom sheyesh chilul Hashem ein cholkin kavod l'rav. Whenever there is a potential chilul Hashem, and we all might be thinking, well, a naked Jew in the middle of the market might be a chilul Hashem, but in the rabbinic context, chilul Hashem is not used as we use it colloquially. Chilul Hashem means that there is a breach of God's word. And God, in the biblical text, tells us not to wear kilayim. God, in the biblical text, does not tell us to preserve human dignity. So he says, when it comes, push comes to shove, if you have kilayim in your clothes, you have to take it off in the market. So again, I would suggest not checking kilayim in the middle of the marketplace. Now, you'll be happy to know those are only the first two lines of this very long source. So we're going to have some complications, but this we're going to draw four principles from this text. Principle number one, biblical law against human dignity. Which one wins? Biblical law. You'll be happy to know that we'll establish, we're not going to read it all because we don't have time, but principle two is going to be rabbinic law versus dignity. Which one's more important?
Dignity.
That's huge. That's huge. Anyone know what shatnez would have to be to be biblical?
Percentage.
It would have to be literally majority woven of cotton and wool together. How many suits?
Linen.
Yeah, linen, all right. It's ox linen, okay? That's all I know. I don't know fabrics, I don't know animals. Yes, it would have to be literally woven together to be biblical. Nowadays, you don't really get suits unless you specifically want that. You don't get jacket suits, trousers, skirts, dresses. That doesn't really happen. Usually, if there is shatnez, it's used in the lapel, and that's where they tend to look. Sometimes it's used in the stitching around the sides, which you'll all be happy to know, is a problem. It's rabbinic kilayim, rabbinic shatnez. But if you find out that you have underwear with, what was it, linen stitches made of wool, I don't know if that sounds very comfortable, but if you had that, you would not have to take that off, because that would be rabbinic kilayim. So we can establish, that's principle number two. And as I say, that's huge, because rabbinic law, most of the time, unless we're killing people, is what orders most of our lives. Because the rabbis were consistently finding ways to keep us from violating biblical law. So most of the things that we navigate are rabbinic in nature. On Shabbat, most of the things that we navigate are going to be rabbinic in nature. So if you tell me that breaking Shabbat rabbinically overrides human dignity, that makes a huge other way around, is overridden by human dignity, that makes a massive difference. Okay, so principle number one, biblical law against human dignity, biblical law wins. Principle number two, human dignity against rabbinic law loses. So let's look at a couple of cases. Look at Gimel in this source. Ta Shema, and I meant to underline this, but it was already PDF by the time I wanted to do that, and I couldn't get into the document. Ta Shema, this is Gimel. We're all trying to find ways to disprove what Rav said. Again, Rav said, you're in the middle of the market, you figure out you're wearing shatnas, off it comes. And now the Gemara goes through five different attempts to reject that statement by saying, but we've got a statement that says this, and we've got a case that we said that. The first case was, if a Kohen is walking home with a mourner, and there are two paths to go home, and it involves walking through a field that may have graves in it, and the mourner goes that way. As a Kohen who's escorting him, it would be undignified for him to walk home by himself, but maybe you have to go the other way. And the case law said, you should follow him for his cover. For his dignity, you should follow him through the impure field, which for a Kohen is a biblical prohibition. So that seems to disprove Rav. Rav said, biblical law, dignity, biblical law wins. The case law said, biblical law, Kohanim can't become Tame, dignity, which one wins? Dignity. So the Gemara says, it was only impure rabbinically. So rabbinic law gives way, but biblical law doesn't. Bet had a very similar case. Gimel, Tashema, come and listen. Excuse me. Gadol kavod habriot, shadoche et lo ta'asei shabatora. How great is human dignity? It overrides negative precepts in the Torah. Give me an example of a negative precept. I know those are alt scroll words, by which I mean nobody uses them in English unless you're looking at an alt scroll translation of a Gemara. Precept. Negative law. Give me an example of a negative biblical law in Jewish life. There were a few of them in the Ten Commandments. Don't steal, don't kill, don't covet. Okay. Don't adulter, absolutely. That's not a verb, but you know what I meant. Adulterate. Don't commit adultery.
Okay.
Fornicate, this is good. Synonyms, anybody? Good point. Okay, we've reached the end point on the synonyms. Thank you. So we have, for some odd reason, I've lost my train of thought. Negative precepts. Yes, I knew it. That was a test. Yes. So this statement on its own seems to say human dignity, gadol, is so great that doche, it pushes away a negative law. Meaning, if somebody is about to run to a microphone and they are going to embarrass you, what are you legally allowed to do? In fact, talking of Shawshank Redemption, that's what the warden does. When somebody's about to give testimony that the guy who was wrongly imprisoned was wrongly imprisoned, he takes him out back, has a little conversation with him to make sure that he's really going to give this testimony, takes his cigarette butt, puts it on the floor, gives a wink to the sniper, and goodbye, my inmate friend. He was in the way, he was going to embarrass him, he was involved with all sorts of money laundering. And on the face of it, it sounds to me like that's being endorsed by this statement which flies in the face of Rabbi Yehuda. Lo ta'asei shabatora is being pushed away. You can murder to preserve dignity. That's what it sounds like. Carry on. Va'amai, how could it be? Lema, we should say, ein chachma ve'ein tvo nevein etzel neged Hashem. We should say, no, I can't kill. God says I can't kill. Doesn't matter if it doesn't feel good. There's no wisdom, there's no counsel, there's no understanding, there's no sentiment before God. He says, don't kill, so you're embarrassed, get over it. That's what Mishlei says, that's what Proverbs says. How can it be we have that statement? Targum Rav Bar Shavo Kame Rav Kahana, beloved Lotasur. Oh, it's only talking about one specific negative precept, which is Lotasur, which is code for, you have to listen to the rabbis. You have to listen to the sages of the age. There is a principle, lo tasur mimin u'smol. You shall not turn left or right away from the sages of the generation. That's a negative precept. To which All the students in the room laughed. Achichu ale, they started laughing. Laughed alotasa, it's all right to hear. You haven't saved anything. That's a biblical verse. You're now telling me a biblical verse can be overridden by dignity? What have they done to the rabbi who made that statement? Just out of interest? They've laughed in his face. Okay, so they've been quite happy to move away from, to show in their action that shame is not that important. Amar Rav Kahana said, Gavra Rabba Amar Milta. If a great person says something, lo tachichu ale, don't laugh at them. Again, enacting the principle that dignity is key. Kol mili de rabbanan as michinu alav de lo tasum shum kavod shari rabbanan. Rabbinic law isn't just invented by, I think you say, the seat of their pants. Is that something you say? Rabbis don't just make this stuff up, and they don't just invent their own authority. The biblical text grants rabbis authority to legislate in the same way that there are constitutional laws and there are legislated laws in America. Who said that Congress can come up with laws? Anybody know who said that Congress can legislate? The Constitution. Who said the rabbis can come up with rabbinic law? Tanakh, the biblical text, gives them the right to legislate. But, so everything the rabbis legislate is actually founded on that principle, but part of rabbinic legislation, according to this view, is that they give way in front of dignity. Even though they're founded on a biblical precept that allows them to legislate, part of their legislation involves that any time human dignity is going to be compromised by our law, it gives way. So those are two central principles. There is another major principle that comes out of Hay that I'll say outside. And next time, please God, we'll move into some concrete examples of this in rabbinic life. And I can tease you with a couple of examples if you like. But principle number three we're going to come out with is that actually even biblical law gives way in the face of human dignity in very specific circumstances. If you are passive. So if you have an obligation, let's say, thank God you have a baby boy, as the father, you would have an obligation to give a Brit Milah on which day? Eighth day, all being well. Biblical obligation to do that. You're on the way to do the bris, you've, for whatever reason, it's a fast day, whatever reason, family couldn't get in time, you're doing it right in the evening, right before nighttime, you need to get it done. And in the meantime, you're on the way there, tragedy strikes and you see a body in the road, a mace mitzvah that needs to be buried. And it's suffering from indignity. That's basically the principle of mace mitzvah. It's got indignity. What do you do? We've just said, Ein tfuna, ein chachma, ein eitzel l'neged Hashem. I've got an obligation to give my son a bris. So he'll have a little bit of indignity and I'll deal with that later. The assumption based on Hay and the reading of the pasuk is that actually, b'shev v'altase, if you are passive, meaning I'm going to not do a biblical law, I have an obligation that I won't fulfill, dignity comes first. So let's just summarize three basic principles. The fourth is kind of minor. I know we have to do Marv in minus 1 minute, by which a minute ago. So I'm going to summarize very quickly the three principles that come out of this. And then we'll summarize everything and then we'll wrap up. Number one. Principle number one. Biblical law versus human dignity. Human dignity caves. Rabbinic law versus human dignity. Rabbinic law caves. Biblical obligation positive human dignity. Biblical law caves. You've got a mitzvah to put tefillin on. I'm sorry, I'm only thinking of male-oriented mitzvot. You've got a mitzvah to put tefillin on every day. You couldn't make it in the morning. You were sick, you were ill, you were running. It's getting close to dusk. You're about to miss it. Someone's dignity is at risk. Somebody's standing in the street not clothed and you want to help them. What do? You're going to miss the mitzvah of tefillin. Biblical mitzvah, positive obligation, human dignity. Human dignity comes first. Again, I'm not paskining here. You shouldn't say, okay, I'm going to take all my clothes off and then I'm not going to have to put tefillin on ever again. We'll have other conversations if that's your choice. But we're now going to have to implement these principles through all sorts of cases. And just a pretty light one. There's some pretty heavy ones that involve decisions about abortions where this comes into play. But there's a light one, which is, imagine for a moment, it may be difficult, you're a rabbi of a community. The chance to embarrass yourself is heightened almost daily because you stand in front of people and say embarrassing things almost daily. It doesn't have to be embarrassing, but you can have slips of the tongue. We all have slips of the tongue, but often we talk to a small unit or one other person or maybe even ourselves in the mirror. But as a rabbi, you have to stand in front of people, you make slips of the tongue. There's one particular time a year when the chance to embarrass yourself is almost daily, the Omer. I have one late night, I don't make it to Maariv, I'm on a flight, I miss one night counting the Omer, night number 3. What do I then have to do for 46 days? What am I not allowed to do? Can't say a bracha. I actually don't know what the minhag is here. Does the guy davening or the rabbi says a bracha for the Omer?
If the rabbi is here, the rabbi does.
If the rabbi is here, the rabbi does. I won't be here. So if the rabbi is here, the rabbi does. I miss night 3, and I've now every night got to stand there and say, could somebody else do it? I missed the bracha. Oh, nice! The rabbi's not doing the Omer. Very nice. Let's put that up on Facebook. So what do? My dignity as a human being, I'm being shamed every single night. And a bracha levatala. Is bracha levatala min haTorah or mid Rabbanan? Rabbinic or biblical? Good. Yes, correct. The answer, machlokes, we tend to pass again, and this might astonish you, that it's rabbinic. It's rabbinic. What are you doing? You're blessing God. What a wonderful thing to do. But we don't. But so most people feel that if you're a rabbi and you miss the Omer one night, you can say the bracha for 46 nights so as not to embarrass yourself. Now that I've said that every night, you're going to presume that I missed it. All right, I'll bid you all a good night and a happy Thanksgiving.